Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Janet Faith Yeomans makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. She's well known to many people for her work on the Daily Telegraph, but also she's an author. So I'll introduce our speaker briefly. Janet Faith Yeomans is chief reporter at the Daily Telegraph, where she covered the Lynn siege. And you'll recall that the Daily Telegraph put out a special edition of the siege. I think it was the only newspaper to do so, and the first with the breaking news. And before the coroner's report, the recent coroner's report, Janet Faith Yeomans did a 16-page wraparound of the Daily Telegraph, which effectively predicted what the coroner's report would contain. She's written about 8 books, I think, but including a biography of Heath Ledger, and is currently writing with Hazel Barrow, My Mother, the Serial Killer, the story of Dulcie Bobsworth. Now, it's not Janet's mother. The co-authors. It's always handy to blame your co-author, so it's the co-author's mother who was the serial killer. But that's for later. But for tonight, we're very grateful to Janet Faith Yeomans for coming to talk to us on Lessons in Terror, the Lynn Cafe Siege, and the Brighton Attack. Janet Faith Yeomans, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Good evening. Now, all of you here tonight will have some familiarity with some parts of the Lynn Cafe Siege, whether as part of your job or from newspaper and TV coverage. It would be easy with the familiarity of repetition and time to know the facts while forgetting the emotional impact of the unfolding events. So with that in mind, I want to try and put you inside the Lynn Cafe in what were the final fatal moments of the country's first terrorist siege. The reason I've chosen to concentrate on those final few minutes is because for me they sum up the handling of the siege. It was the best and worst policing. So at 2:03 a.m. on Tuesday, December 16, 2014, Man Monis fired his first shot after one of 6 escaping hostages knocked over a glass. Inside the cafe, there were 6 hostages left. 2 of them crawled behind one of the serving stations. Another 2, including Katrina Dawson, hid in the corner of the cafe between the foyer doors and Martin Place. Louisa Hope, who was not prepared to leave her mother Robin behind, was pulled up from the floor by her bra straps by Monis and put in front of him along with her mother as he used them as human shields. They were told to close their eyes and keep them shut. Then Monis turned to the cafe manager, Tory Johnson. "Come over here right now," and then ordered him down, down, down on your knees, indicating with his head and the sawn-off shotgun where he wanted Tory to kneel. Tory's knees were later found to have been bruised, which really moved me. At the same time, Monis was scanning the front of the cafe from left to right, as if waiting for the police to enter. At 2:11 a.m., he fired the shotgun for the second time, and Tory fell forward onto the floor with his hands still at his head. But Monis had fired towards the kitchen, and Tory lifted himself up and kept kneeling. One of the hostages, Selena Wynne Pei, heard Tory gasp, "Oh my God." Then Monis reached across his body and pulled out a fresh cartridge from the right pocket of his cargo pants. He loaded it into the shotgun and started to psych himself up with heavy breaths. Louisa Hope described what happened next. "I can say that I did not hear any word from Tory. He was distressed, but as time went on, he stopped crying. He stopped being distressed. He had composed himself." At 2:13 a.m., with the end of the gun barrel just 75 centimetres from the back of his head. Tory was shot dead. Katrina Dawson was hiding under the chair behind Monis when Tory was executed. Outside the cafe were the country's toughest and best trained police. But the tactical operations unit officers had not been able to operate. The snipers couldn't snipe, and the negotiators had not been able to negotiate. After that third shot, in the old Westpac building on the other side of Martin Place, the lead sniper, Sierra 3-1, radioed, "Sierra, white window 2, hostage down." His call was echoed by the sniper in the Channel 7 building opposite the cafe. A hostage was dead. That was the trigger for the police to storm the cafe under their so-called Emergency Action Plan, the EA. For over 15 hours, the TRU officers with Alpha Team, wearing 25 kilos of uniform in the December heat, had been waiting along Phillip Street out of sight of the cafe. They had been itching to go in from the very start. This is what they had trained for. The tactical commander radioed to them, "Echo Alpha, this is Tango Charlie, commit the EA," followed by the code. No one moved. The broadcast had failed. His deputy took over and shortened the command. "All teams commit the EA," and repeated the code word 3 times. But the ballistic shield man who would lead the Alpha team into the cafe still didn't hear the order. His radio hadn't worked all day, and there had been no replacements. The order had to be relayed to him by a fellow officer. And you all know what happened next. QAD. I actually recently did a community and policing course, and we were in a room where the TRU officers came in. I think you did as well, Margaret, didn't you, with the stun grenades. We had earplugs in and noise-cancelling headphones, and it was terrifying, absolutely terrifying, even though we knew it was going to happen. So the TRU stormed the cafe, killed Monis, found Tory's body, and Katrina Dawson could not be saved after being hit by fragments of police bullets. As a state coroner, as you know, spent months investigating the police response to the siege and the background of Monis, who should never have been in the country in the first place. Never has a police operation come under such scrutiny. The coroner's report runs to 472 pages, and you can read it online, because I can't come near to examining it all in half an hour. The bravery of those officers standing in Martin Place can never be questioned. They went into the cafe aware that if Monis really did have a bomb, as he claimed, they would all probably die. But they went in nevertheless. Yet it can be argued that the politics and police bureaucracy behind the scenes may have cost lives. Those of us reporting on the inquest were fortunate to be in a separate media room watching proceedings on a big screen. Initially, of course, we wanted to be in the courtroom to be part of the action. But being in our own room allowed us to express our frustration, amazement, and anger at what we heard, without being thrown out of the court. There were times we looked at each other and actually said, "Did I really say that?" There were also a couple of very good mimics amongst the reporters who could take off certain of the lawyers in court. I wish I could demonstrate that here, but it will be immediately obvious to those involved who I meant. Now, none of the reporters were experts in policing or terrorism, but we had certainly sat in our share of court cases and inquests, and some of the evidence we heard literally made our jaws drop. None more so than the fact that one of the hostages had to be murdered before police would move to save the rest. Should the police have stormed the cafe earlier? Certainly, at least after the first shot was fired. Would the outcome have been different? Yes. Would all of the hostages have been saved? Perhaps, or perhaps not. It's very easy to say that police were always going to be criticised. Damned if they did, damned if they didn't. If they had gone in and Monis had a bomb, we would all be here smashing them for going in too quickly instead of waiting. But hope is not a plan. That is what is drummed into those counter-terrorism officers all the time. Hope is not a plan. But hope in the end was all they had. Hope that Monis would walk outside the cafe and peacefully surrender. The snipers couldn't snipe until someone died or was in imminent danger, because they would leave themselves open to be charged with murder. They had no more protection than you or I in the street. Now, they're trained to hit a target the size of a dollar coin from 100 metres. But the only time they had Monis in their sights was for 10 minutes, from 7:38 p.m. on the Monday. The rest of the time he was behind pillars in the cafe. As well as this, the sniper with the best view, who was in the old Westpac building, that's Sierra 3-1, couldn't have fired at all, because even with the armour-piercing ammunition he had, the round would not have reached the cafe. Tests conducted afterwards showed that because the Westpac glass was insulated, double glazed, and 30 millimetres thick, the ammunition immediately fragmented. No shot would have reached the cafe. It was concluded that breaking the glass first with a breacher, a big hammer, would have been so noisy it would have alerted Monis. Now, they now have some new method to get through the glass. What it is remains secret. Even I don't know what it is, because they blocked it out in the coroner's report. Then we come to the understaffed and under-resourced negotiation unit. They didn't negotiate because Monis refused to speak to them. The inquest heard how they missed chances to secure something from Monis in return for giving in to his demands, however minor. At 12:28 p.m. on the Monday, police moved back some officers from near the cafe after a demand by Monis. Around 30 minutes later, they moved cars back after another demand by Monis, but they asked for nothing in return. The only officer open to making a deal with the gunman if they could get even some of the hostages out was Mick Fuller, who is now the police commissioner. Within 5 minutes of the 000 operator sending out the alarm, he had taken control as the first overall commander. 2 minutes later, he called out the TRU. One of the first demands made by Monis was to talk to ABC Radio. Fuller thought it worthwhile considering letting him talk to the ABC in return for releasing half the hostages. He gave the green light to negotiators to discuss this deal with the gunman. But the head of the negotiators, and there are only two full-time negotiators in the state, which I think is going to change, the head of the negotiators thought it was the wrong thing to do because it was against the government's policy of not making concessions to terrorists. He didn't go back and discuss this with Mick Fuller. He just didn't pass it on. He thought it may have been catastrophic because Monis could have used the radio to send messages to accomplices. He thought the deal wasn't worth it. So the message was not passed on. Meanwhile, the tactical operations unit was left without any tactics. Basically, they had the two options. The EA, or Emergency Action Plan, which, as I've said, would be triggered by the death of a hostage. That plan was drawn up immediately. The other option was a deliberate or direct action plan, a DA, under which police would assault the cafe at a time of their choosing to take Monis by surprise. This was the TRU's preferred option, and a DA plan was drawn up. The TRU commanders looked at the plan and thought it would work, and indeed at about 10:45 p.m. on the Monday night, the Australian Defence Force told the police that members of its tactical assault group had conducted a run-through of the DA plan using a mock-up of the cafe, and they found it was tactically feasible. Once the plan was approved, it would still require an order to put it into action. It was not automatic. It was never approved. The overall police commanders felt the possibility of Monis having a bomb too great a risk to take. So when Monis fired his first shot at 2:03 a.m., the police had backed themselves into a corner. They had no option but to wait until someone was killed. Now, less than 2 weeks after the state coroner, Michael Barnes, handed down his findings, there was another terrorist siege, this time in the Melbourne suburb of Brighton. The gunman was very different to Man Monis, but at the same time, there were similarities. To the public, both of them came seemingly from nowhere to kill. But they were both known to police. They'd both faced court on terrorist-related offences. Both had connections to extremists. They'd both been written off as not being particularly dangerous. Monis was on bail over the murder of his wife and a string of sexual assaults. Jacob Kare in Melbourne was on parole for aggravated and theft offences. And in releasing him on parole, the Victorian Parole Board had taken into account the fact that he had been acquitted of planning a massacre at Holsworthy Army Barracks in 2009. The siege in Melbourne showed how Islamic State is constantly updating its tactics. The same online IS magazine that suggested stabbing and the use of trucks to mow people down, which has been used to such devastation in Europe, had called in its latest edition for followers to use classified ad sites like Gumtree to lure people to meetings, restrain them, and hold them hostage to lure police into an ambush. And that's exactly what Jacob Kare did. He posed as a client to hire a prostitute to meet him at the Buckingham Service Departments, from where he rang Channel 7 and said, "This is for IS, this is for Al-Qaeda." When police arrived, he burst from the apartment and opened fire. He was shot dead. Now, in New South Wales, a review of procedures had just roared through the police, even before the coroner's findings were handed down. At first, when I read those findings, like a lot of the other reporters, we thought, well, having sat through the inquest and heard all the evidence, that was quite a timid report. But when you drilled down into it, you realise that the coroner didn't miss anything. He was actually very clever because he uses subtle language that basically tore the police operation apart without laying blame at any one individual. So if or when there is a second terrorist siege in the state, it'll be handled completely differently. While you can argue that every siege, every incident is different, I believe the next such attack will be met with more courageous tactics. Police Commissioner Mick Fuller has already said he would probably have ordered the storming of the cafe after the first shot. Significantly, the coroner found that the police negotiators relied too much on the advice of their regular psychiatrist, whose name has been suppressed, who thought Monis was, quote, grandstanding. He no longer works with the police. The coroner found that the snipers would actually have been lawfully justified in shooting Monis from soon after the siege began, and he found their locations were as good as they could get. The laws have now been changed to give the police clear protections to shoot to kill terrorists. It was also interesting to see the federal moves to change the laws so troops can more easily be called in to help police situations like the Lynn siege. There's been a lot of talk about the armies, and I hate this, but it's what people do, about the army's elite troops. Well, the New South Wales Tactical Operations Unit, the police, the guys at the siege, already train alongside their counterparts in the army. They all train exactly the same. All the police experts from the UK and the coroner himself said that the state police could handle the Lynn siege. It would have been different if Monis had accomplices when the army may have been called in. But while using the army sounds great, if they kill someone, are they going to do a blood and alcohol test, like the police do? Hand their weapons over for ballistic testing? Participate in a police interview? Attend an inquest and give evidence? Don't think so, and they can't be forced to. So just returning to the final moments of the siege, one person I know who's been closely involved with the SAS told me, every time there is a door to walk through, everything behind it is unknown. It can be anticipated, but it is unknown. Which could also be a philosophy for life, I guess. Anyway, thank you for inviting me tonight, and thanks for coming along. And I hope that was interesting.
Well, many thanks to Jennifer Fierman, not only for her important address tonight, but also for the reporting in the Daily Telegraph over some years. So we've got plenty of time for questions and discussion, and we've got to the top of the hour if we need it. But let me just raise one separate issue, because as you know, there was this concept of Man Monis as a lone wolf. But I think it's true to say, I'm not sure, so I'm asking, is it true to say that we still don't know where he got the weapon from?
That's correct, we don't know.
And it is interesting why we don't know that. I mean, someone in the Sydney community, or the Australian community, must know where he got this illegal weapon from. So what did the coroner's report, conclusion did the coroner reach on that matter?
Okay, well, the shotgun had been imported into Australia quite legally. I can't remember how many years earlier. Probably to be used on a farm or something like that. He obviously got it illegally because he didn't have a permit or a license. And the cartridges he had were all different cartridges. He had none of them matched. I can't remember how many he had now, 6 or 8. None of them matched. Initially, the police thought he may have got the sawn-off shotgun from the rebels. I don't know if you remember, he tried to join the rebels biker gang, and even they wouldn't have him. He just didn't want anything to do with them. They took his house. He bought a cheap Harley Davidson from overseas or something, and they took that off him. Initially, the police thought he got it from there, but they still don't know where he got it from. So it was imported legally. It wasn't an illegal weapon in the country, but he had it illegally.
So he either got it from a criminal entity, or he got it from someone who was in on a terrorist attack.
He may not even have got it from a criminal identity. He may well have picked it up from somewhere who didn't realise it was going to be used illegally.
Okay, so question here.
Why was the psychiatrist not named, considering everyone else was named, and do you think he's been referred to his professional organisation for censure regarding his incompetent advice?
Well, he hasn't actually been referred to his... he hasn't been referred to the psychiatric board or whatever governs the profession. I don't know the reason why he wasn't named, because everyone else was named. The magistrates were named. The prosecuting lawyers, who may not have prosecuted the applications to have bail refused properly, they were named eventually. And he wasn't named probably because he might be hated or for his own safety. I don't know, but I can't tell you who he is. In fact, we couldn't even describe him at in the details as to actually what he did. It was very vague. We can only call him a psychiatrist that the police used.
But we know he's a male.
Yes, he's a male.
Don't hold all males against
him. Okay, so yeah. Just hang on a second. There's a... We'll give it to Ida, right? Yeah.
And then it goes over. Thank you so much. Can you tell us about the psychiatric report prior to the Link Cafe siege, and secondly, was there something to be learnt from this type of siege
abroad? Well, the psychiatric report before the siege, they actually had a number of psychiatric reports on him, and I don't think they had a psychiatric report. He went to see a number of psychologists and a number of GPs who all had different views on who he was, whether he was schizophrenic. He managed to trick a lot of them into thinking he was something that he actually wasn't. So there wasn't actually a pull-together report beforehand that anybody could actually see, which was one of the things that should have been done. And also, he was being investigated by the homicide squad, and also he was being investigated for the sexual assaults. And the police computer systems weren't compatible. So one lot of the police couldn't see all of the reports that another lot of the police had, so that was all quite in fractions and bits and pieces as to what they had. But there wasn't one particular psychiatric report about him for them to rely on at the time. Afterwards, they did a lot of psychiatric reports, which found that he certainly wasn't mad at all. Not at all. And what was the other question?
Was there anything to be learned from sieges that had occurred?
Was there anything to be learned from sieges overseas?
It didn't actually go into that in detail. They had some experts from the UK who obviously had a lot more practice in terrorism than we've had. One of my earliest memories of watching television was watching, was it the Iranian embassy siege in London, where they abseiled down the outside in the middle of the World Snooker Championship, and they just moved across to seeing that. And that just sticks in my mind because they took such decisive action and just went in and got it done. They probably couldn't do that now because you'd have computers and be able to follow everything that's being done. So they didn't go into any of that detail, but obviously they learned from... I mean, our police go overseas all the time and talk to people from over there, and they come here and talk. So I think a lot of people probably learned a lot about the Lint Cafe siege as well. I don't know if that answered the question.
Question here.
Hi, yes, Louise Waterhouse. It seems to me that the underlying constraint through the whole siege was this backpack, that everybody was worried. He said, as he said, he had a bomb, etc. But at the same time, it seems to me that he must have, he had a drop-dead button or whatever they call it, they must have been aware that he wasn't always holding the button, or there must have been some way they could make an assessment about this backpack and where, you know, some way to be able to take that out of the equation, because that seems to be the elephant in the room, the fact that this backpack was a dummy.
But absolutely. They were also criticised because they went to search his house to see if he had any bomb-making equipment, and they looked at his computer, but they didn't actually go and search the house until much later on in the evening after they'd arrested his girlfriend, Amira Drudis, thinking that, or fearing that she may have also been involved and may have been a liaison to other people. And in fact, as you know, all he had in his backpack was an old stereo speaker with a few... And there was also a dispute whether there were wires coming out, but they certainly could not be positive that it wasn't a bomb. Even though he claimed to have other bombs around Sydney, and they were all found to be false. So they never were confident enough to discount it. The TOU discounted it. They didn't think that it was a bomb. And also they were willing to go in anyway. I mean, when they did go in, if he did have a bomb, they would have been killed then, just as they would have done had they gone in 12 hours earlier.
But it seems to me there must be a procedure that they can say, if someone threatens to have a bomb, what do you look for? What are the signs? You know, do they have a button that they have to press? Do they have this? Do they have that? There must be some way of analysing.
There's not actually a procedure that they have. They just look at everything individually and see what it is. And there were conflicting reports as to whether there were wires coming out of the back or whether there weren't wires coming out and what kind of wires there were. And also at one stage, at the beginning, when he went in to order his cup of tea and chocolate cake, he actually left the backpack on the floor for a while and asked one of the waitresses to look, I think it was Ellie Chan, just to look after it for him. So you would think if he really had a bomb, yes, he wouldn't just be leaving it around like that. Mm. But right at the end, they just couldn't discount that he had a bomb, and that's why they wouldn't go in earlier.
Yep.
As we watched that footage, when they got to the very end and went in, what stunned me was that there were many more casualties. The amount of firing and the amount of shooting seemed to me to be over.
A lot of it was stun grenades, though. They sound like shots, but they weren't. In fact, I think there were 23 shots fired, so that you have the ballistic shield man going in, and the shield is so heavy, it's just, I think it's 13 kilos by itself. He's holding that, he has a pistol. Then you had Officer A and Officer B behind. Officer A went in, and he fired 17 shots that had the laser pointer on Monis, and he'd never shot at anyone at all in his life. And the laser pointer went up Monis's body, and he shot 17 times, and it got up to his head and basically blew his head apart. Meanwhile, Officer B went round to the side, and he fired 5 shots, but he fell down. So I think that was 23 shots fired altogether. So it wasn't actually a lot of shots. It sounded like a lot, but they were the stun grenades. And the coroner, obviously Katrina Dawson's family, thought the police had fired too many because she was caught by, I think, 7 fragments of police bullets. But the coroner found that there wasn't an overuse of... they hadn't fired too much. And he also found that they hadn't used the wrong ammunition, because there was some question about whether the ammunition they used would ricochet and other ammunition they could have used wouldn't. But he found the ammunition was the best to use under the circumstances. So it sounds like a lot, but it actually really wasn't.
But 17 shots at one man with a laser direction seems like a lot of shots. It doesn't sound like a crack shot to me.
It happened like that. It happened.
Huge amount of shots. No wonder they had ricochets.
They just wanted to make sure that he was dead. Actually, none of the bullets actually ricocheted from him. I can't remember. I think all of them may well have been still in his body. I think a couple might have gone through, but most of them... Yeah.
There's a question up the back. Yep.
Hi, I was just wondering, coming from the UK, and we have heaps of horrendous terrorist attacks, and they're pretty hard for the normal person on the street to deal with. In your role at the Daily Telegraph, knowing this level of detail that you've discussed going to the inquest and such, does it make it so much harder to deal with and kind of process, or does it kind of give you that level of understanding that kind of makes it better to understand that most people wouldn't have?
Well, I love my job and I love all that detail. Not really doesn't bother me. I find it really interesting. But I actually have never been into the Lint Cafe. I never went. I hadn't been in beforehand just because I hadn't been there. And I actually haven't wanted to go in because I don't really want a picture of everything that happened.
There's a question. Oh, right up the back and then down here. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Gwen, you mentioned the police radios weren't working. I mean, surely there must be SOPs about checking the radios before you actually go into action.
They weren't fixed all day. They weren't working all day.
Why didn't anyone do anything about it?
I agree entirely. I don't know. And I can't remember what the coroner said about that, so I apologise for that. But that was one of the criticisms, was that they hadn't been working all day. But then the negotiators were negotiating out of a small room in the Leagues Club, because they usually had a negotiation truck, and it had been hit by lightning about 3 years earlier and never replaced. It may not have made much difference, but in the truck, they had it was just like a big white anonymous Pantech truck. But they had cubicles in there, they had whiteboards, they were all set up. They didn't have that truck either. So they were operating, so you had radios that didn't work, you had them operating out of one small room. I think they only had one landline into that room, and if they were on that phone, the hostages calling out got flicked onto other lines in other parts of the building. And there were times when there was no one in that room to actually take their calls.
So, okay. As a result, quick follow-up, what has now changed, and are we sure that next time around they'll have the truck or a number of trucks, because a truck in Sydney is not going to be any use if there's a Newcastle siege or a Wollongong siege or whatever, take too long to get there.
Well, they actually still haven't got the truck yet, and if there is a siege in Newcastle, they actually have officers in those areas and they can get there very quickly, but you're quite right, they don't have those things all over the state. But they do have negotiators in all of the police stations. There's various people they train as negotiators, but they're not the full-time negotiators. But it's a good point.
Oh, hello, my name's Katrina Seelig. I was just wondering, I mean, can this actually be characterised as an act of terrorism? I mean, was there a search done of his computer and his phone and whatever to see if he'd been in contact with other people or, you know, of that sort of ideology? Or I'm just interested to know whether it was just a misfit.
No, it was declared a terrorist siege, definitely declared a terrorist siege at the time, and the coroner found that was justified. But there was never any evidence that he'd actually contacted anyone from Islamic State or... I mean, he didn't really know very much about Islamic State, if you remember. He took the... is it the Shahada flag that he thought was an ISIS flag, and it wasn't? And he actually asked for an ISIS flag when he realised he didn't have one. And the police tracked one down somewhere, but they didn't give it to him. So there was no evidence that he'd been in contact with anyone else. So he was very much a lone wolf. But they found he was certainly inspired by what had happened overseas. And if you remember, he was convicted of writing letters to the families of Australian servicemen who had died in Afghanistan. Self-serving stuff. And also he had his girlfriend, Amira Drudis, in a burqa on his website, and he was always, you know, declaring war against this, that, and the other. So he was definitely classed as a terrorist, but totally a lone wolf who had never spoken to anyone else.
Question here:
do you think the role of the judiciary, the legal system, was fully understood by, or not understood, but investigated by the coroner? That there more, could have been more criticism passed on.
We may just background that. So this is a criticism about, I guess, the decision to give parole.
Bail.
I'm sorry, bail. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, just background that.
Yeah, you're right. He was on bail for organising the murder of his wife, who was stabbed to death and had petrol poured on her and set on fire by the girlfriend, who's in jail now. And he was also on bail for 33, I think, sexual assaults that he had committed in his spiritual healing business. And initially, we were like you, we wanted the magistrates and the judges who had granted him bail to be dragged along there. But as it turned out, it wasn't their fault. It was actually, if you're going to look for a fault, one of them was the fault of the prosecutor, who was found not to have prosecuted the case properly. The police prepared him a statement of facts and a lot of background, which he never handed up, whereas Monis's lawyer was much better prepared. He tried to say that they were very busy and, you know, he had a lot of cases on. So that was the first time he was on bail for the, it was a murder or the sexual assaults. The police then wanted to appeal it, and they wrote a letter to their boss asking if he would hand it up to the DPP to appeal it. And the evidence from Mick Willing, who was then head of homicide, was, quotes, it would be like pushing shit uphill to get the DPP to do anything. So they never handed it to the DPP. And then the next time he went, after a few other court things, and you remember the bail laws were changed in the middle of it all as well. Margaret probably knows more than I do about this, but the laws were changed so there wasn't a presumption against bail. You could get bail if you could find ways of controlling the threat. So then he went back before the court, and he was facing the murder. He was facing sexual assault charges. He had a whole lot of new sexual assault charges placed on him as well. But that DPP prosecutor, who was doing his first bail hearing in a New South Wales court, he was from, I can't even say which country he was from, I think I can now, he's from England, he didn't actually apply for bail to be refused. And the police were criticised because they didn't arrest Monis on the new sexual assault charges, because if they'd arrested him, that would have been easier to get bail refused. Instead, they served him with court attendance notices. So he turned up at court as a man who was already out on bail. So it really wasn't the judiciary that made the mistakes. I think it was more of a mix-up of the prosecutors and perhaps the police by not charging him at the last time. But at that last time as well, nobody realised that he was actually already out on parole at the time of the murder and the sexual assault charges for sending the letters to the families of the Afghanistan soldiers. So it was just a complete mix-up.
But in normal circumstances, if Bill Smith had gone before a magistrate with 35-something cases of sexual assault allegations, would it be normal, whatever the DPP said, would it be usual for a magistrate to give that person bail?
Well, I think the magistrate has to rely on, or the judge has to rely on what's put to them. You would think that the judge or the magistrate would look at it and say, well, look, I'm looking at this before me, you know, prosecutor, because they're not crime prosecutors either. They were the solicitors. They would look at it and say, but he's already charged with this and he's already charged with this. So I don't know what the magistrates or the judges had before them. I would have locked him up, but I work for the Daily Telegraph.
One of the critical elements has to be the mental state of the perpetrator.
Could you speak into the microphone?
To your mouth.
Yeah, go on. Yeah.
One of the critical elements has to be the mental state of the perpetrator. Yeah,
just put it to your mouth.
Now, does anybody give any thought to any relationship between someone like Monis, who on any basis I think would have to be regarded as at least unusual, and you've alluded to the fact that a whole range of different professionals seem to have quite different views about him when they interviewed him professionally, and people who, for example, in domestic violence cases take hostages. In those cases, on the whole, many of them either commit suicide or alternatively give up.
Yeah, we've got to move on. Go on. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Was there any thought given at this coronial inquiry to any relationship? Is it possible to generalise
okay.
about how people behave?
It was certainly that there was a lot of evidence from the negotiators in the tactical operations unit. They were actually out first thing that morning as well, working on, you know, other arrests, and they do a lot of domestic violence sieges, and usually those people give themselves up. But in this case, he was totally unpredictable, really. And he wasn't mad. He knew what he was doing. But he didn't talk to anyone, so they couldn't talk him out of it. The idea was to get them talking and have some negotiation, but they didn't at all. I don't know if that answers the question. But.
Okay, there's a question here. Just hang on 1 second. We'll go over here. Oh, okay, we can get the microphone. No, that's fine. Here we go. Just speak
Thank you, Janet. Janet, we know from what you've said and perhaps from our own observations that the tactical operations unit were very well trained, very keen to go in bravely. some of their equipment had failed, certainly, but what do you think about the idea that the boss police were terrified to move in this case because of the Islamic flavour of it? If it had just been someone without that, just a normal person having a siege, wouldn't they have gone in quicker, killed them and not been worried about, oh no, they've killed a Muslim?
Well, that's quite interesting because the head negotiator said that the only advice he had about dealing with a Muslim or a Muslim terrorist was what he called Muslim 101, was how he described it, which was basically just a couple of hours training. So nobody actually even negotiated with him from that Islamic point of view or as a terrorist. I think they were just hoping that he would come out. So they hadn't actually thought about looking at that side of things at all because they hadn't had any training in it.
But just following up the question, I mean, this guy, Monis, was well known in Sydney. If you watch the commercial news or the ABC news, he was frequently in his Islamist gear,
yep,
walking around Sydney, demonstrating, causing problems. I mean, when I was, Anne and I were overseas when the tragedy occurred, and the minute I saw the shot of this man, which I happened to see when I was in Israel, I knew exactly who he was. I told our Israeli friends who this guy was because I knew all about him. I'd read about him in the Telegraph. The Telegraph in particular had covered, and the Australian too, I think, but particularly because it's a Sydney paper, the Telegraph had covered all this. I mean, this guy was, in a sense, the visible face of Islam on the streets of Sydney. Probably better known than most, and his case had gone to the High Court. The High Court had divided 3-3 because there are only six judges sitting. So he was he wasn't just Bill Smith from Wodonga. I mean, he was a big figure, wasn't he?
Absolutely right. They didn't confirm it was him though until I think later in the afternoon. That morning in the cafe, the barrister who had just represented him in the family court was actually in the cafe that morning and bought a takeaway coffee and sort of waved at Monis as he went past. He went back to his chambers, and later on that morning when he saw what had happened, he wondered if that was Monis, but it was a few hours before he contacted the police hotline, and then he had to call them back again. So it was a while before they realised it was actually Monis. The police investigating the homicide recognised him as well. When they recognised who he was, I don't actually think they ever dealt with him as a terrorist, even though they acknowledged it was a terrorist siege. He wouldn't talk to them. They didn't know how to deal with an Islamic terrorist. They didn't know what to do about it. Then they couldn't talk to him. There was nothing that they did that they could engage with him on anything at all.
I think it was someone... we've got to be quick. We're getting towards the end, so... Yep.
Monis came in as a refugee and the rebel biking gang wouldn't let him into their club. What does that say about him?
Now, he didn't actually come in as a refugee. He actually applied for a visa to come to Australia as some consultant, working for a company that had some consultancy with BHP. So they just stamped his visa and he got a visa. When he got here at the airport, they asked him why he was coming, and he said he was here to sell carpets, to deal with carpets. And there was no one cross-referencing what he put on his visa application and what he was actually here for. I think he was here for about a month, and then he applied for refugee status. And one time they think he is a refugee, and then, you know, a few months later they're going, no, he's not a refugee. And ASIO is going, oh, you know, we flag him as someone who's dangerous, and 6 months later they've changed their mind and said he's okay.
But should the rebels be a screening for
a I think we'll just move here. But you might mention his background. I mean, he came from Iran as a Shia, but before the Lint Cafe murders, he said he had become a Sunni.
Yes, he was just a bit of everything, really. I can't think of an easier way of saying it. He claimed he was everything.
Well, let's go here. We've got to be brief here.
Okay, just quickly, then, do you think that the police at the top level were playing the way they normally play a siege, is the contain and negotiate, that putting aside the Islamic terrorist component, that just the assumption that if they stood around long enough, he would give up at some point?
That's what I said. They were hoping. That was hope, was not a plan. They were just hoping he would give up.
Now, we're going here. Have I missed anyone? Because we're...
You mentioned before, Janet, that he wouldn't talk to anybody, but he was demanding to speak with the Prime Minister and other people. Why wasn't there something done? Would it come up in the coroner's inquiry that they could say, well, look, the Prime Minister's not available, but here's his PA or here's somebody that can talk to you, so they could start saying, yes, we're getting to him, and as one does, leading him on into some way of getting, as you said before, a benefit?
Well, as I said, it was only Mick Fuller who ever thought that they should actually allow him to talk to anyone like the ABC. They would never allow him to talk to the Prime Minister. They were wondering he might be able to pass on some sort of secret messages in what he was saying or to any accomplices he may have had.
But the Prime Minister could have become the negotiator.
They don't allow that. There were other people who offered to negotiate. The Grand Mufti offered to, you know, he was offered to negotiate, but they won't allow third parties to negotiate. They have to do it themselves. That's one of their rules. They won't do it.
I suppose on the basis they give the message to the Prime Minister, there could have been some way.
They could have thought of ways of doing that, but they didn't, because that's not what they do. They don't give in to terrorists.
Given that the laws have changed to allow snipers now to snipe in cases of terrorism, are there moves afoot to have the laws changed such that if the army is brought in, they're protected similarly to the police?
I don't know about that. I can't help you with that, because they've never ever operated on Australian soil. But if they're going to look at calling the army in, then they're going to have to look at that. And also ways to get the army to give evidence and get involved in the inquest should anything happen and inquiries afterwards. So it's not just as simple as just calling the army in.
But the army has operated on, you know, so at the time of the Hilton bombing, because there was a meeting of Asian heads of state here, Malcolm Fraser, the Prime Minister, put the army on the streets. The Australian Army guarded the railway line from Sydney down to Bowral, where they had their meeting, and this was never really... Later on, Malcolm Fraser sort of pretended it hadn't happened, but Fraser actually put the army on the streets with virtually no authority, and we can understand why he did it. It was a pretty desperate time because no one knew who'd done the bombing, but there was a precedent where the army was engaged.
I didn't realise that. I was told they'd never operated on Australian soil, and that was what was said at the inquest. So,
this is for a terrorist criminal attack. Now, the army was the army, and it's in the official history. Mm-hmm. The army was put on the streets of Sydney in 19. The Hilton bombing is either 76 or 77 or 78.
So, February.
I was working for the minister, or a minister who was advised about this, whose background was in the army, who told me about it right at the time, but it did happen. But that's 40 years ago. I mean, to be fair, that's a long time ago.
That was at a time before any police groups were trained as they are now.
Okay, so same. It's the time before any police groups were trained, which is a good point here. There's a question here. Can we get...
As a journalist, do you characterise the ABC Four Corners special on the Linstage Cafe as being well put together? And I say that in the context of they portrayed it, to me anyway, as a comedy of errors.
I haven't actually seen it. When the coroner's findings were handed down, I actually wasn't here. I was up in the Kimberley, and I can't believe he handed them down when I was on holiday and totally out in the middle of nowhere. When we heard they were going to be handed down, I haven't watched it yet, but I have heard people who have seen it and thought that it was very well put together. Yes, you could look at it as a comedy of errors. Yes, there were mistakes, especially when the police were going in the door in Martin Place, in the Martin Place foyer, and they managed to stun themselves. It was a bit like Keystone Cops. And I don't think a comedy of errors would be too cruel, I think. I think that's a bit too cruel to decide how they did it, because they all thought they were doing the right thing, whether it turned out to be right at the time.
I think that's a very good spot to end on. So, Jennifer Yeomans, thanks very much. I mean, obviously this is a very important story in Australian history and also a very tragic one. I mean, two fine Australians died, were murdered, others were traumatised, and you've covered it extremely well tonight. And others had to make decisions which... and the police and others, which none of us would want to make, and they bore a heavy responsibility for what happened at the time and what happened after. But it is important that we know the facts, and what you've done tonight for us is put down the facts. This speech will live on in publication and in recorded form, and you've taken so many questions on a wide range of issues which demonstrate that as a journalist, you've done what good journalists, great journalists should do, which is get on top of the facts and explain the facts. People can draw their own conclusions, but you've just told us what happened. And for that, we're very grateful. We'd love to have you back when your next book comes out, because it's one of many. But for tonight, thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.